Science Fiction University.
Hello and welcome to Science Fiction University.
We're your fan and writer hosts. I'm Blue Gal.
And I'm Drift Glass. And you can visit Science Fiction University at our website, sciencefictionuniversity, all one word, .com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a Patreon button at our website. Or you can mail us a letter and or contribution to Science Fiction University, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. Warning! This episode contains major spoilers for an 84-year-old short story and a 73-year-old movie. So, you have been warned. In previous episodes, we discussed the relationship between original science fiction source materials and television and movie adaptations of that material. In the case, for example, of Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the novel Dune by Frank Herbert, we found that Villeneuve had very skillfully combined and cut and compressed story elements to make it filmable. Some stuff was left out. Some stuff is like, but it worked. He did a great job. Now, in the case of Apple TV's adaptation of Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, on the other hand, so foreshadowing, baby. It's all about foreshadowing. Yeah. Apple did spend a lot of money. They spent like $50 million per episode. Oh, I'm sorry, per season for two seasons so far. That's $100 million to make the series look great. And you know what? It does look great. The problem we had was that the Apple Foundation series trashes the core science fiction premise on which Asimov books are based. And it goes on to mess up with other critical parts of the story and the original plot in ways we could not abide. So reluctantly, we stopped watching.
Yeah. I mean, holograms of people that made no sense. If you've read the book, why? Why is this person here?
Holograms are fine for Harry Seldon, who comes back in the form of a hologram every 20, 30 years. But having him cloned and alive or not and going back to his home planet or not. No, he's dead. And, and by the way, the psychohistory on which the entire series is based is premised on the fact that everything is inevitable. That everything is coming to pass because it has to happen this way. And we position the foundation in exactly this place on exactly this planet so that the intervening dark ages would be shorter, be shortened by 90,000 years or 9,000 years, 90,000 years. And, but in the series, they just throw all that out the window, you know, entire plot lines rest on someone getting conked on the head with a wrench. And that is not at all.
It's not how this story is supposed to go. Yeah.
So, you know, it looks pretty. And if you've never seen or if you've never read the Foundation trilogy before, you might really enjoy it. And good for you. This is a big free country and you can enjoy yourself in that way. But for us, it was like, no,
this is not the book.
Did you even read this book? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and the exact opposite is true of Dune.
Right.
Because if you've read Dune and then you see the movie, you see how the director made a decision that really worked to explain big parts of the book.
Yeah.
Exactly. And yes, there are parts that he had to sadly leave out of the movie that I miss, but it doesn't stop you from enjoying the film.
Yeah. It's like, you know what? We're going to swap out spice. We're going to substitute Lunchables. No. Don't you understand?
Only the pizza Lunchables, not the chicken Lunchables.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, some juice pouches instead of that magic water. No! Anyway.
And we also saw how this process can go very wrong in the last two to three seasons of Game of Thrones, where Benioff and Weiss actually ran out of original source material. The books ran out. And HBO still wanted the money.
Yeah, let's go.
So by the end of the fifth season, they suddenly had to start building out the world on their own. And they sort of forgot that, you know, the queen is supposed to wind up the queen and is a good person. And she's been victimized in season one. And now she's knows about poor people. No, that doesn't. It just completely they just do this right turn.
Yeah.
It's just wrong.
She made a she did make a scowly face and then became an evil person. But
well, it made no sense and it did not end well. And people were disappointed and I think they should have been. Now, this is not science fiction. This is fantasy, as we have mentioned before. But we have previously touched on the fact that Star Wars suffers from the same defect in that there really was no world building going on in the original trilogy at all. You just get plopped into this universe where there are alien worlds, of course, alien races, but we're basically presented with a fairy tale with laser swords. Right. We don't need to worry about the internal politics of the Empire or how the Force works or how spaceships and droids and lightsabers were manufactured. Mm-hmm. We're just presented with all of that as established facts. And it's a really sturdy frame in which to set John Campbell's hero's journey, which is what it is. It's a young knight setting off with a band of companions to rescue a princess from an evil villain. Boom.
Boom, boom. Easy,
that's
right?
What Star Wars is. You know, New Hope, that's what it is. It's simple, it's fun, and there's nothing about imperial taxes and trade disputes.
No.
Which would be really great if that never happened. Mm-hmm. But George Lucas decided to make some prequels. And then he has to start explaining how things work and how they got that way. And we get imperial taxes and trade disputes because George Lucas has to sell Happy Meal toys. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, all of the junk in those movies, in those prequels, is extra aliens, is to sell Happy Meal toys.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything does go off the rails because he's missed the story. He's missing the core of the plot.
Yeah.
Now, so what do you think, Driftglass, about world building and adaptations and this and the what we're going to talk about next?
I think Cinderella would be a lot less interesting if in the middle of the story you said, "Now, what about the mortgage on this house?" You know, what have they got in escrow? What's the equity in the house?
And can she do some? Has the prince been tested for STDs?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's no.
He's going around trying on shoes. There's fungus. Mm-hmm. We really need to talk about this. Yeah,
but. But it turns out, again, this is more writerly stuff. It turns out, it just so happens, there are actual exceptions to this rule of adaptation and world building. And in some cases, a screenwriter or a director can take the plot of a well-known science fiction story. In today's example, it's a very good story. And then almost completely gut that story while preserving a few important story elements, change the entire thrust and the message of the story, and still produce an excellent adaptation. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And here's the opening line of the short story, the 84-year-old short story that we're going to be discussing today. Quote, "From his perch high on the ladder above the museum floor, Cliff Sutherland studied carefully each line and shadow of the great robot, then turned and looked thoughtfully down at the rush of visitors come from all over the solar system to see Newt and the traveler for themselves, and to hear, once again, their amazing, tragic story," unquote. And FYI, we're pronouncing it Newt. In the story, it's spelled G-N-U-T, and it may or may not be a reference to an Egyptian goddess who's in charge of the sky, stars, cosmos, mothers, astronomy, and the universe generally. So, probably is.
It's just such a good first paragraph. First paragraphs open you up and give you lots of information when they're well written. And this one immediately identifies the story's protagonist, Cliff Sutherland, where he is on a perch above the floor of a museum, and his presence is not alarming anyone at the museum, so presumably it's okay for him to be there. This exhibit is drawing people from all over the solar system. So the exhibit is very popular, and this is taking place in a future where there are people all over the solar system. The exhibit is about Newt and some sort of traveler, and their story is both amazing and tragic. And we learn all that just in the first couple of sentences.
Yeah, good writing. Good writing.
The story is entitled Farewell to the Master. It was written by Harry Bates and first published in the October 1940 issue of Astounding Science Fiction, which means this is more than a year before the United States entered World War II, 2 years before Germany developed the first functional ballistic rocket, and 4.5 years before the United States successfully tested the first atom bomb. This was golden age science fiction, which is a little ironic since Harry Bates didn't start out as a science fiction fan. He just sort of fell into it. In the 1920s, he began working for William Clayton as the editor of various adventure pulp magazines. When he and Clayton were kicking around ideas for a new magazine, Bates suggested several alternatives that he said would be easier to edit. And the result was Astounding Science Fiction.
You know, spoken like a real editor. Let's pick something that's easy for me to edit.
And then we'll get lots of submissions and we won't have to pay the writers all that much.
Yeah, perfect.
Bates edited the magazine from its first edition in January 1930 until March 1933, when it's the 30s. Yeah. Clayton went bankrupt and the magazine was sold to Street and Smith.
Now, as an editor, Mr. Bates thought most of the science fiction stories of the time were crap. He thought they were sloppy and badly written, and they were. If you go back and actually read, you know, 80% of everything is crap. They're bad. It's that 10%, 20% that are really excellent that survived to the present day. But yeah, there's a lot of garbage out there. Same thing with every medium. This is what he wrote about the magazine Amazing Stories. Quote, "Once I had bought a copy, what awful stuff I'd found in it. Cluttered with trivia, packed with puerilities, written by unimaginables. But now, at the memory, I wondered if there might be a market for a well-written magazine on the amazing themes." Unquote. Hey, how about that? Quality science fiction. Maybe somebody will buy this stuff. Now, in 1964, Bates was asked about his editorship of Astounding, and he said, quote, "Long ago, I was a party to the genesis of a magazine which persisted through 30 years and 30 millions of words. Astounding was a living being. I served it in its infancy and childhood. Orland Tremain brought it through youth and adolescence. John Campbell guided it through adulthood and maturity," unquote. And Farewell to the Master reflects that style of writing. It's fast-paced. It clocks in, at least in my copy, about 26 pages. It's grounded in reality. It's set in a real American city with a protagonist that comes across like a real person. He screws up, and sometimes he lets his fears get the better of him. It has several twists along the way, with one very big twist at the end that pays off all the questions the story has raised along the way. But the short story bears very little relationship to the movie which inspired it. This short story features a protagonist.
Well, the movie was inspired by it.
Oh, I apologize. Yes.
Right? Yeah.
The movie was inspired, loosely inspired, sort of tangentially inspired by the story.
A couple of words in the story inspired the movie. Yeah.
But we'll get to that, how that all happened in just a minute. Yeah. This short story features a protagonist who's a newspaper photographer. In the story, there's a rampaging gorilla that suddenly drops dead in the museum. Six smashed up museum robots. There's a dead mockingbird. And there's two identical dead guys, both named Stillwell. So, you know, I'm already interested. I think Vera would find this case fascinating. Just fascinating. This is what's described in the story as a time spaceship. Not a spaceship. It's a time spaceship that's in the museum. And it mysteriously appeared on the grounds of a major U.S. city. It didn't fly in. It didn't land. It wasn't spotted by radar. It was just suddenly there, just instantly. The story has an ambassador from the stars who we barely get to know at all before he's murdered by a deranged assassin hiding in a tree using a ray gun. There are also audiovisual records of the first four or five words spoken by the ambassador before he's killed, and a massive mausoleum where he is buried. In death, this is how the ambassador is described. Quote, "He lay as if asleep, on his face the look of godlike nobility that caused some of the ignorant to believe him divine," unquote. But other than that, the story contains no religious allegories or references at all.
Now, does any of this suggest any science fiction movie you've ever seen or heard of?
Mm-hmm.
No? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not surprising since none of it appears in the movie version of this story. I mean, this is really amazing to me that the filmmakers credit the author of the story at all, because I could easily see them deciding not to.
Yeah.
But they really had to, because there are these elements of the story that appear in the movie. The spaceship carrying the travelers lands in Washington, D.C. The ship contains a humanoid creature and a menacing 8-foot-tall robot. Both the spaceship and the robot are made of some kind of indestructible metal.
Mm-hmm.
And to try and contain the robot, the military encases it in an extremely tough kind of plastic or lucite or transparent material. The robot melts the plastic material easily and escapes. And that's it. But that is enough to hang the story of the movie on the framework of the short story. The movie, however, was released 11 years after the short story, 1951.
Yeah.
And that context is critical. 1951 is 6 years after the end of World War II, 2 years after the Soviet Union tests its own atom bomb. Both superpowers were working on their own ballistic missile systems. And this is Cold War America. This is the Red Scare. This is McCarthyism. This is the media making money off of terrifying the American public that there's a communist under every briar patch. And America's on edge. They think they're going to be bombed. They're fearful that an attack could come at any time. And they're afraid that government has been infiltrated by communists.
Mm-hmm.
And then into your local theaters comes this trailer.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. The arrival of a space ship in Washington. The Army has taken every precaution to meet any emergency which may develop. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Oh, and one more thing. The alien ambassador's name in both the movie and the short story is Klaatu, as in...
Klaatu, Barada, Nikto, Klaatu, Barada, Nikto.
Yes, we are talking about the day the Earth stood still. We're talking about the terrific 1951 version, not the 2008 version, which has been charitably described as, quote, a subpar reimagining of the 1951 science fiction classic, and about which we shall speak no more.
Oh, but it has Keanu Reeves in it.
Yeah,
and he's such a deep, emotive actor. No, he's not.
He is. He can be. But in this movie, they told him, give us nothing. Give us nothing at all. He is flat as a plank and give us absolutely nothing. It was a terrible idea. Bad, bad, bad dog. Now, the 1951 version was directed by the very good director Robert Wise, and it starred Michael Rennie as Klaatu and Patricia Neal as Helen Benson, Locke Martin as the man in the Gort suit, Sam Jaffe as Professor Barnhart, but everyone knew it was supposed to be Albert Einstein. Billy Gray as Bobby Benson, and Hugh Marlowe as the Judas of the story, Tom Stevens. And of course, that amazing, ominous score by Bernard Herrmann that carries you right into the movie from the opening credits on.
Dead.
Supreme Court has delivered another blow to the Voting Rights Act.
Despite growing dangers from climate change, tonight the U.S. Supreme Court curbing the government's power to fight it.
The makeup of the Supreme Court, the decisions they have already handed down, and the cases they are hearing this year are not coincidental. So what is next? What can we expect from this chaos court and the networks at work to serve them up cases that will expedite their agenda? We'll seek to answer those questions, examining issues at the heart of the cases the court is currently deciding. Follow Grave Injustice wherever you get your podcasts. We're releasing episodes every Thursday throughout the season.
But we also want to highlight the screenwriter, Edmund North, who managed to do something really kind of miraculous. He transformed an excellent short story about a male protagonist, Cliff Sutherland, observing a giant space robot named Newt, in which the humanoid ambassador is barely seen, into a fantastic 90-minute movie about a humanoid space Jesus ambassador with an urgent message for humanity, his killer robot, a war widow, and her son.
Humanoid space Jesus ambassador just makes me crack up, but it is true. That's what
it is. Absolutely true, yeah.
This is from the next few paragraphs of Farewell to the Master, the short story. Cliff Sutherland, our protagonist, describing what he has seen and heard so far. Quote, he himself had come to feel an almost proprietary interest in the exhibit, and with some reason. He had been the only freelance picture reporter on the Capitol grounds when the visitors from the unknown had arrived, and had obtained the first professional shots of the ship. He had witnessed at close hand every event of the next mad few days. He had thereafter photographed many times the 8-foot robot, the ship, and the beautiful slain ambassador, Klaatu, and his imposing tomb out in the center of the tidal basin. And such was the continuing news value of the event to the billions of persons throughout habitable space, he was there now once more to get still other shots and, if possible, a new angle, unquote. And then a little further on, quote, the last of the crowd admitted in the present group hurried in, exclaiming at the great pure green curves of the mysterious time-space traveler, then completely forgetting the ship at sight of the awesome figure and great head of the giant newt. Hinged robots of crude man-like appearance were familiar enough, but never had earthling eyes lain on one like this, for Newt had almost exactly the shape of a man, a giant, but a man, with greenish metal for the man's covering flesh and greenish metal for man's bulging muscles. Except for a loincloth, he was nude. He stood like the powerful god of the machine of some undreamt of scientific civilization. On his face, a look of sullen, brooding thought. Those who looked at him did not make jests or idle remarks, and those nearest him usually did not speak at all. His strange, internally illuminated red eyes were so set that every observer felt they were fixed on himself alone, and he engendered a feeling that he might at any moment step forward in anger and perform unimaginable deeds. A slight rustling sound came from speakers hidden in the ceiling above, and at once the noises of the crowd lessened. The recorded lecture was about to be given. Cliff sighed. He knew the thing by heart. Had even been present when the recording was made, and met the speaker, a young chap named Stillwell. Unquote. By the end of the story, all of this pays off. But almost none of it has anything to do with the day the Earth stood still. No. I mean, there is no protagonist like this telling the story. There is no Cliff.
No, at all.
At all.
No, it's very different. And yet you can just see the little bit of DNA they teased out of this thing. So now, as a public service, I am going to spoil this 84-year-old science fiction story. So if that bothers you, well, that's just too bad. Sorry.
Well, you can always skip ahead.
Yeah, you can.
But it is an 84-year-old short story.
Yeah. And I got it in a copy of a book of a collection of such stories. I had it years ago, and I lost it. And my
and
wife
your wife ordered, found it online and ordered
she did.
It for you.
And I looked, and all my favorites were in there. Oh, my goodness. Oh, all the good stuff. So, and yeah, we happened to be talking about doing this episode of The Day the Earth Stood Still. I thought, wait a minute. I think I have both the DVD of that, and we do, and the short story tucked away, and we did. And so, Wowza, let's do that. I took a bunch of notes in a little notebook here, so you might hear some pages rustling, but I'm going to give you the highlights of this story for free, no extra charge, and here we go. You should know that 85% of the story takes place in a museum, usually at night, with just these two characters. There's some interaction going on outside, but it's very, very contained. It only gets.
And the two characters are Cliff and the robot.
Cliff and the robot. Okay. Yeah, Cliff and Newt. So Cliff's a photographer, and Cliff is starting to compare. He's been he was the first photographer on scene when the ship first arrived, and he notices very subtle changes in Newt's face or posture, like he moved. Except this robot has been standing there for 3 months, completely immobile. Has no sign of life except for the glowing eye, just a statue as far as anyone's concerned, except it appears that it has moved ever so slightly. So he decides to hide in the museum at night, and he finds a place to tuck himself away up in a science lab on the second floor, overlooking the floor. And the museum shuts down, and it gets dark, and lo and behold, Newt moves. And our hero is kind of staring and staring and staring, and gets kind of lazy and kicks back for a few minutes and then looks around, and boom, Newt has moved right up close to him.
Silently,
you don't even hear him, but he's moved like the wind, but he's not after him. Newt then goes to the ship and opens the ship, which is impossible to open. Human beings have been trying to do it for 3 months. Walks in, and he swears, our hero swears, that he hears the sound of mockingbirds singing, birds singing. And then there's this sound, and then no more bird. And the bird is dead. And holy shit. And then Newt goes right back to his spot and freezes again. And our hero was so freaked out, he took like bad pictures. He's a professional photographer. He's taken two pictures that prove nothing. So he decides to come back the next night and see what happens. Or this might all happen on the same night, but I think it happens the next night. And he comes back, and this time there's the sound of animals roaring. Newt moves again. He cruises back to the ship. He goes inside. Now there's the sound of animals roaring. This big snarling, roaring sound. And out of the ship comes bounding a fully grown gorilla. And the gorilla is angry. And the gorilla goes around the museum, smashing the museum robots. And our hero, our protagonist, can't figure out what the hell's going on, except it's terrifying because now there's a gorilla loose in the museum, a very angry gorilla, except the gorilla gets very weak very fast and dies.
Hmm.
This is not good. So he puts the story out and wants to go back one more time and observe what's going on, and says, you know, I think I have a story here, to his editor or whoever. Let me go back in one more time. And this time, he can hear that recording going off where the guy Stillwell is talking about the museum. Welcome to the museum, ladies and gentlemen. Except the voice starts to stutter and then it stops. And it's coming from inside the ship. And out of the ship comes Stillwell. And Stillwell confronts him and walks up to him and goes, What am I doing here? What's going on? I was just recording this message and now I'm here. And the guy says, you know, I know you. You know, you're Stillwell. You're the guy who was recording the message. And what happened? What are you doing here? And he gets very weak and very sick, and he dies.
And then right in front of him?
Right in front of him.
Oh.
And Newt is now very disappointed and gathers up all these things, these dead things. And because the people who'd inspected the museum the next day after the gorilla died said, wait a minute, there's gorilla hair in this place, and there's gorilla blood around here. What the hell has been going on in this museum? Newt then comes back out of the ship with a dead mockingbird, puts it by the busted up robots, puts the gorilla on top of that pile, puts the dead Stillwell next to the gorilla, and puts an identical copy of the dead Stillwell next to the other Stillwell.
This is weird.
This is deeply weird. So our protagonist is completely freaked out, runs screaming out of the museum, attracts attention, gets people going, like, what's that? The police intervene, and they would like to talk to him about the two dead bodies in the museum, because the robot, you know, Newt is just standing there, and it certainly can't be him. And he says, look, you can arrest me, you can take me downtown, do whatever you want, but please let me borrow your radio and talk to my agent or the media or somebody, because I think I have a story here that's so big, all humanity is going to want to know about it, and I can retire off of what I can say. My story is going to make me rich. It's going to be crazy rich. And the cops go, okay, that's fine. So the cops arrest him, and eventually they take him downtown. He's not guilty. And they tell him, no, the Stillwell guy, he's alive and well. He's living upstate somewhere. This isn't him. This is a duplicate of him. I don't know how that happened, but it's not him. Well, that's freaky. And so a group called the Continental Bureau of Investigation wants to talk to him about that too. That's the FBI, except for the entire, I guess, you know, North American continent. They would very much like to know what the hell he saw. And they're much more gentle with his questioning because it's clearly something major is going on. So they're now convinced that this giant robot is a problem. So they encase it in something called Glastex, which is an advanced form of plastic so that he can't escape, right? So, and they surround the museum with a cordon of army guys with artillery and ray guns. Remember, the ambassador, Klaatu, was killed by a lunatic assassin with a ray gun hiding in a tree. It wasn't the army that shot him. It was a nut job. So there are ray guns in here. Now, the funny thing is there's ray guns and there's spaceships and robots, but you still have to take your film back to your hotel room and develop it chemically. There's no digital photography in this future. Okay, that's fair. Fair enough.
We know from the very opening of the story that his goal is to find a new angle for this mausoleum guy. Like, absolutely. That's the whole point.
He has a professional interest in it. And he's been inside the museum so often that when he goes in at 5 minutes till closing, nobody thinks about it. They just, you know, they say, oh, it's him.
Look, you've been here all the time. Yeah, and we've seen you all the time.
He finds a place to hide so he can watch what goes on at night. But of course, Newt melts the plastic off himself easily. And the army just throws everything they have at him. Ray guns, artillery. The artillery knocks him down. He gets back up. The ray guns melt the door behind him, but don't affect him at all. And he goes tearing off into the direction of the tidal basin. But he stops because Cliff has made an arrangement to be like the pool reporter for this event. So he's up in a tree and he's got agreement from all the other media outlets that he's going to watch what's happening with all the equipment and all the stuff, the infrared stuff, and he'll tell them what happens. And instead, Newt spots him and goes to where he's hiding in the tree, tears the tree out of the ground, grabs Cliff, puts him on his shoulders, and runs straight for the tidal basin where the mausoleum is. Like, he's going to make pay his final respects to, I believe the quote is, his beautiful and adored master. And that's repeated over and over again. It's Newt is the robot, and he's repeated over and over again that he's the robot, he's the servant, he's the constructed engine of this thing. Klaatu is the master. That's why it's called Farewell of the Master. The master dead and gone, etc. And he goes ripping down there to the tidal basin mausoleum, cracks it open easily. Newt reaches in, looks at his master, looks very concerned at the dead body there, and picks up all the recording equipment and all the tapes that were made of him that are still in there as signs of respect. Because humans built this mausoleum thinking, we don't want the next group of visitors showing up thinking that we killed this guy because we're bad people. We like to show great respect for this person.
I see.
Because you guys have spaceships and you could probably kick our ass, and we don't want there to be any misunderstanding. So they built this beautiful mausoleum, which is now cracked open. And they go back to the ship, and Cliff thinks he has an answer, because it turns out Newt has been making copies of living creatures using recorded sounds of their voices. That's why he did the gorilla. He had a recording of the gorilla.
Oh.
That's why he did Stillwell, because he had a recording of Stillwell. And they have the technology to reverse engineer a person out of the sound of their voice. But all these things die because the recordings are all imperfect. And Cliff says, well, I think I have an answer to that. You get the original recording equipment that this was taped on, and we can figure out what the defects are and correct for them. And that's when that's when Newt speaks up and says, what? And this is, we're back.
Because all of a sudden he can get Klaatu and make him alive again, right?
Well, he's resurrected another Klaatu inside the ship, but Klaatu almost immediately starts dying. And there's some...
Just like the gorilla and the Stillwell.
And he's telling Cliff, don't worry, it's not your fault. It's just, you know, the recording was imperfect. And he's very sad because this great godlike creature from heaven and his pet robot are, have been so cruelly disappointed. This is a first contact story. And we screwed it up really bad.
First thing
that happened. Hi, my name is Klaatu. Boom. One to the head. Boom.
Yeah.
Is what drew them to the story. That's what drew the producer and director of the story, because there are no bug-eyed monsters.
Right.
And humans are not the good guys.
Right.
That was a very rare thing in science fiction of the time.
Well, and Americans are not the good guys. It's not just humans. It's not some rando human in outer space.
Right.
It's Washington, D.C.
It's the heart of the government. And we are panic-stricken, and we're prone to gossip, and we can't control our people. And the first thing that happens is some fanatic in a tree kills this ambassador.
Then
Newt drops the big bombshell at the very end, which is, you misunderstand. Basically, Klaatu is my creation. I'm the master. And off he goes. But that's the plot to the story. And you can see it's a cool story. It's certainly very well written for 1940. It's tight. It runs along really fast. But it has virtually nothing to do with the day the Earth stood still.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that
but you
is
can the, see why they decided this is really, this part of it's really interesting.
There are certain elements in
Greetings
here.
Earthmen, bang.
Right.
Is a great sort of hook.
Right. First thing, right out of the box.
For the story. Right, right.
So I hope you've enjoyed my Farewell to the Master TED talk. And
absolutely. So if you've ever seen The Day the Earth Stood Still, and if you haven't, it's time for you to stop listening and go watch it.
Right. Right now. Go.
It's really a good movie. It really is.
It holds up really well.
Yeah. You can't help but notice right away that this is not what Dirk Glass just talked about.
No.
So we have to talk about how this happened. How did we go from one to the other? And the answer has a lot to do with the context in which each version of this story is being told. Farewell to the Master was written in 1940 and is set sometime in the future where, you know, there's people from the solar system visiting this museum. Mm-hmm. They live elsewhere in the solar system. We have sent spacecraft to Mars. We make our own robots. We have advanced weapons. Apparently, we don't have digital film yet.
No.
Right?
That's one thing they got wrong. Yeah.
But we don't dwell on all of this progress. But we're given enough detail to know this story does not take place in the here and now. It's a futuristic story.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, The Day the Earth Stood Still, released in 1951, and it is clearly set in the present time.
Mm-hmm.
The cars, the newspapers, the post-war mentality, the clothing, it's all present day. And the director even cast famous present-day newsreaders like H.V. Kaltenborn and Drew Pearson as themselves. It's like when Wolf Blitzer appears in a Mission Impossible movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
As Wolf Blitzer on CNN, see the TV and it's CNN and he's telling the news, right? Disaster movies often use this kind of trope of finding someone to actually read what's happening as explication. So, yeah, they used current radio announcers that people would know who they were and cast them as themselves so that audience would know, yep, oh, this is right now. This is 1951. And around the breakfast table in the house where Klaatu is hiding out, residents make a crack about the Democrats. And Frances Bavier, who is Aunt B from the Andy Griffith Show, she's very good at playing gin rummy in this movie. And she makes it clear that she thinks communists are behind a lot of this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just saying the communists.
She doesn't say communists, but she goes, you know who I'm talking about.
You know who I'm talking about. You know who might be behind this spaceship stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a know-it-all.
Yeah.
And a very typical Washingtonian know-it-all, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are shots fired at the media, too, for spreading panic. I love this scene. There's this point at which a man on the street, radio news guy, has a big microphone. He's carrying a big rig around his waist. And he's working his way down the line of people. You know, it's Fox News man on the street in this Ohio diner.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, you know, this person is terrified and this person is also equally scared.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's asking them, how scared are you? I mean, he's really pumping it up. And he gets to Klaatu.
Mm-hmm.
And it's played for a little bit for laughs because he's going to ask the space alien. He doesn't recognize him.
Right.
And Klaatu says, well, what I'm really concerned with is that people believe wild rumors and are given in to irrational fear. And of course, the Fox News guy, he's not Fox, but he is, just says, yeah, thank you, sir. Moving
Thanks,
on.
Never mind. And the newspaper headlines are all screaming, Martian man on the loose.
Yeah.
The
right,
citizens
right.
terrified. It's like, and it's just this guy. And he's living in a boarding house.
He's just a guy in a suit with a briefcase. And in the 1951 film in Washington, D.C., soldiers are everywhere. But in the 1940 story, the army shows up early in the story to cordon off the spaceship, and then they don't show up again until near the end of the story when Newt breaks out of the museum. And they just open fire on him with no effect. In the 1951 movie, the military is there from the beginning. Soldiers on leave walking around D.C. Soldiers on the military base that spots the ship. It's a trigger-happy soldier that wounds Klaatu at the beginning when he's trying to give them a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Klaatu is then taken to an army hospital for treatment. And then he's held prisoner there by, you know, uniformed military. Mm-hmm. When Klaatu escapes and puts on his Stop the World demonstration, that's the day the Earth stood still, half hour where Klaatu freezes all of the engines. It's the army that takes charge. They blockade the city, they hunt Klaatu down, and they do kill him. They shoot him to death.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who try to get the meeting of world scientists and experts canceled for their protection.
For their own protection.
Now, this is a little bit off topic, but it really does apply, because if you've ever read any analysis of the Bible, the Christian Bible, you immediately run up against the problem of the really stark differences among the Gospels. They're all supposed to be telling the same story. They all purport to tell the same events, the same story, but they're all very different from one another. They have elements in common, but for example, one Gospel is written specifically for a Jewish audience in and around the Jewish homeland and makes it clear that it's the Romans who are to blame for the crucifixion, period, full stop, damn Romans did it, etc. But another Gospel, which was written later and written as marketing material for the Gentile and Roman audiences, because you don't want to piss the empire off. Maybe we can get the empire to become Christian. Who knows? You don't want to say that it's their fault. So, nope, Romans didn't do it. They were forced into it by the mob.
So yes, it's true.
It's absolutely for that reason. Different context and different audience. So it's the same historical event, but written for different audiences under a different context. Now, the 1940 short story is classic golden age science fiction. The story of us screwing up first contact with an alien species. They bop by for a visit. We panic. Some idiot with a gun kills the one we are led to believe is the leader. And the rest of the story is Newt trying what appears at first to be random actions, but instead turns out to be an attempt to replicate Klaatu. But all his experiments on the mockingbird, on the gorilla, on the Stillwells, they all fail because the recording he's using is imperfect. And Cliff, as I mentioned, thinks he knows a way that can be fixed. And that is the first time that Newt actually speaks out loud.
Yep.
This is a quote from the story. Quote, as the last words left his lips, Newt whipped around like a cat and gripped him tight. A truly human excitement was shining in the metal muscles of his face. Remember, Gort has no expression. Gort is a statue, but Newt has a human face that expresses fear and anger and sadness and excitement. Get me that apparatus, he ordered, in clear and perfect English. He started pushing Cliff towards the door, but Klaatu raised his hand. There's no hurry, Klaatu said gently. It's too late for me. What's your name, young man? Cliff told him. Stay with me to the end, he asked. Klaatu closed his eyes and rested. Then, smiling just a little but not opening his eyes, he added, and don't be sad, for I shall now perhaps live again, and it will be due to you. There is no pain. His voice was rapidly growing weaker. Cliff, for all the questions he had, could only look on dumb. Again, Klaatu seemed to be aware of his thoughts. I know, he said feebly, I know. We have so much to ask each other about your civilization. And Newt's. And yours, said Cliff. And Newt's, said the gentle voice again. Perhaps someday, perhaps I'll be back. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
That's an unquote. No, I don't have a civilization. Newt manufactured me. But that's again, that's the big bombshell at the end.
Yeah. And that's it. Newt drops that final bombshell, showing how clueless we really were all along. And leaves. No big speeches, no life or death message, you know, for the ages, right? Just solid 1940s golden age science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the surprise at the end is that the robot's in charge. But by 1951, the real world was a very different place. And so the screenwriter, Edmund North, took a few elements from the original story and reworked them into a screenplay about a messenger from the stars come to Earth to warn us that our rockets and nuclear experiments meant that we had become too dangerous to be ignored any further.
I came here to give you these facts. It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
This story is not about a photographer and a giant robot. This story is about an alien with a dire warning for Earth, who is wounded while trying to give us a gift. He's hospitalized, where he heals himself with some salve he has on him. And while in hospital, Klaatu tries to convince the U.S. Secretary of State to call a meeting of all world leaders, because he has something terribly important that they all must hear. And this is a really sad scene.
It is.
Because, first of all, the technology isn't quite there to simply beam video to everyone, right, on Earth, which you could pretty much do today. And the secretary is sad that he can't give Klaatu what he wants. He says, Earth politics are complex. Such a thing is simply impossible. But this gives the screenwriter an opportunity to work in a little joke about the relative difficulties of time and distance.
I want to meet with representatives from all the nations of the Earth.
I'm afraid that would be a little awkward. It's completely without precedent. And there are practical considerations, the time involved, the enormous distances.
I traveled 250 million miles.
So the military confines Klaatu to the hospital, and he promptly escapes. He doesn't have any problem escaping, no, by the way, no. Ever. And he goes into hiding from the government. He sets about the task of learning about human beings. Mm-hmm. Under the assumed name of Carpenter, I mean, come on, Space Jesus Klaatu moves into a boarding house and befriends a war widow and her young son, Bobby. He looks after Bobby, going with him to Arlington Cemetery, where Bobby's father, the war hero, is buried.
That's a great scene.
It's a great scene.
There's almost no dialogue. It's just Klaatu taking in, you mean all of these graves are people who died in the wars?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty much all of them. Like, wow.
They go to the Lincoln Memorial, and then they sneak into Professor Barnhart's office. And again, this is supposed to be Einstein.
Yeah.
And Klaatu leaves a little calling card for him.
Yes, he does.
I couldn't imagine anyone but Michael Rennie playing this role. The voice, he's tall, he's thin, he's got, you know, this beautiful English accent. And he conveys such a wide range of emotion. He's bemused by human failings. He has impatience and anger with human stupidity and prejudice. When they go to the Lincoln Memorial, he shows reverence for the wonderful words of Abraham Lincoln. And he has just a real delight at hanging out with Bobby and seeing the world through the eager, curious eyes of a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby clearly likes him back.
Right. They're pals.
They're pals.
They're really pals.
Patricia Neal is amazing also. And she's only, as an actress, 12 years older than her son in real life.
Yeah.
But she plays the somewhat weary war widow who has seen great sadness, and she's raising her child in a boarding house. She's a secretary for the government. She's a working mom, and she's very protective of her kid. She's dating the jerk of the story.
Yep.
And she learns that he's not a good guy. In the movie, she's the only character in this movie that has an arc where she is a different person at the end of the movie than she is at the beginning of the movie. And in the end, she's the one who literally saves the world by overcoming her fear and panic and going up to the robot, Gort. And, you know, this is a huge robot that we have seen disintegrate tanks. He's dangerous.
Oh, and Klaatu has told her, he could destroy the world.
He could destroy the world. You have to get to him. You have to get to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dying on the sidewalk, you know, and saying, you got to get to this robot and you've got to stop him because he can just destroy the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has to go and confront him and make him stop.
And she's scared out of her mind.
Absolutely.
She's terrified
of this
thing.
And she should be. And she should be. He is. Mm-hmm. He's terrifying. Billy Gray as Bobby is terrific. He is actually a lead in this movie. And he really comes across as a kid who's had a good mom. He's well-behaved. He's excited. He's curious. He's spontaneous. He doesn't want to go to school. He wants to spend the day with Mr. Carpenter.
Yeah, of course he does.
But without him, there is no movie. And you and I kept saying Steven Spielberg owes Robert Wise $5.
Oh, God, yes.
Because seeing it through the eyes of a child is such a trope now with science fiction movies. But here it is with this one where Bobby isn't really afraid of things.
No.
He goes and sees the robot and sees him doing things that are bad and no one believes him, you know, but he sticks to his guns and he knows that he's being honest. He reminds me, I mean, Robert Wise said he was the best child actor he'd ever worked with. And he reminds me very much of the child actors in Resident Alien.
Yeah.
If you've seen that show, the children in that show, especially the boy, is the only one who actually sees Alan Tudyk's character as he is, as an actual alien. He has the ability to see, oh, I know you're an alien. And everyone else sees Alan Tudyk. But this kid in Resident Alien, it's the same honesty and straightforwardness and knowing I can't tell mom and dad, you know, because they'll think I'm crazy, but I have to do something to both protect, but I'm also a little bit pissed off at the alien, you know? And so here's Billy Gray in this movie saying, I know things are dangerous. I know this is difficult, but I really like Mr. Carpenter too.
Right, right.
So the cast, the cinematography, and the music all come together. And they really elevate this movie from what we think should be a pretty good B movie to a genuine classic. It's shot in black and white, which Robert Wise says that's what I was given. You know, I don't get to choose them. This is not something that they're going to spring the Technicolor budget on, you know, that was not for me. That was not going to happen. But Robert Wise really makes excellent use of the shadows to hide faces of characters, suggest confinement, reveals of a face, to convey a sense of dread, something terrible closing in on us. And the Bernard Herrmann score is just terrific. It's both ominous and otherworldly at the same time. And we should also mention about the special effects of this movie, because there aren't a lot.
No.
The landing of the saucer in the middle of Washington, D.C. really holds up. Director Wise sells it by not just animating the saucer, but also the disc-shaped shadow it casts on the ground as it lands. And the film is deliberately shot in a kind of a documentary style. It's like a travelogue of Washington, D.C. You see the Smithsonian, you see the Capitol building, and here comes this spaceship flying over these places. It's just animated, drawn in, but really well done. And the theory, I think, behind the direction of this was, if you're telling a story about spaceships and aliens and robots, it has to be very well grounded in the everyday real world for audiences to buy into it. The director is also very proficient at using montages to tell the audience about events and how they're happening around the world.
Yeah.
And he uses stock footage. You can see that he is on a budget and has to stretch that budget, but it's done documentary style and very well. It's cut very well, edited. The editing choices he made show a very steady hand.
They do. And the cut to humans around the world all listening to this announcement that this ship is landing in different languages. And at the end, when the crowd is gathered around the ship, it's a different kind of montage because it's all these different types of people. There's, you know, there's Russians there. There are black people in this movie. There are black people in the crowd around the ship. There are
black priests in this movie.
Pastors in this movie.
Yeah.
Looks like a Greek Orthodox minister. It's deliberately supposed to be, this is a story for all of humanity, all of us. This has to include everyone, and nobody can be left out. So let's just talk about Michael Rennie as Space Jesus for a minute, shall we?
Sure.
Because that's always fun. Seriously, we did listen to the commentary track of this movie and a documentary about this movie because, you know, that's the kind of extra value you get at Science Fiction University, you know? For your science fiction dollar, you get a whole bunch of us listening to a whole bunch of things you're probably never going to see.
It's also because Driftglass is a nerd and wants to know everything about it.
I did. I wanted to know everything about this movie before I opened my big fat mouth about it. And now I can, for the next 3 days until I forget all this, I can tell you anything you want to know about this. And when the subject of Space Jesus came up, the director said he was not aware of any Jesus allegory going on in the movie, which, you know, I'll give him this. It might be true. Because perhaps, you know, it was a very fast shoot. Maybe he was too wrapped up in the daily shooting schedule to notice it. But the screenwriter tells a very different story.
Yeah.
This is from, this is, again, extra value for your dollar. This is from a 2001 article by Anton Karl Kozlovic entitled From Holy Aliens to Cyborg Saviors, Biblical Subtexts in Four Science Fiction Films, published in the Journal of Religion and Film, which we got to renew our subscription to that, Blue Gal. I think it ran out.
Sure.
Quote, Edmund H. North himself admitted that the parallels between the story of Christ were intentional, from Klaatu's earthly name of Carpenter to betrayal by Tom Stevens, and finally to his resurrection and ascent into the heavens at day's end. It was my private little joke. I never discussed this angle with the producer, Julian Blaustein, or director, Robert Wise, because I didn't want it expressed. I had originally hoped that the Christ comparison would be subliminal. Unquote. Well, you failed.
You failed. You
failed, dude. And actually, the comparisons to the Christ story do go a little deeper than that. For example, the very innocent Klaatu, who's done nothing wrong, is killed on the orders of a fearful government. He's stirring up tumult among the people. And the killing is done by the military, which is very Roman, very Pontius Pilate. Klaatu is also capable of performing miracles to convince the doubters. He literally heals himself in a way that medical science can't explain. And he stops all generated power on Earth for half an hour, except for hospitals and airplanes in flight, for example, where people could be harmed by it. In another great use of the montage, we see that everything from hydroelectric generators to traffic in Paris and London, which is amazing that how they did that, to milkshake machines, to a tractor on the White House lawn, are all dead for 30 minutes. At the 31-minute mark, they all start up again. And Klaatu's most unaffected and friendly relationship is with that boy, Bobby. Mm-hmm. And that, too, is kind of straight out of the book of Matthew. Quote, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these." Klaatu really likes Bobby. He comments that Bobby's the only one who's not afraid, not jittery.
Yeah.
He's interested and curious, but he's not fearful. And Bobby's mother, Helen, provides a pretty serviceable Mary Magdalene. She is there when he dies. She is the first to see him when he's resurrected. And he's in his spaceship / tomb. And when he's resurrected, we can see that he had a wound in his side. So, Lord. You know, it's right there.
Hammer.
Yeah. Now, let's just be clear. It doesn't take away from the plot.
No.
And if you don't know what you're looking for, it doesn't interfere with anything. But if you're looking for it, you'll find it there.
But there is a religious element to this film that, to me, stuck out like a sore thumb. Uh-huh. And you found out this little nugget, and it made perfect sense to me. After a test screening, the Motion Picture Association of America, who are the people of the Hays Code, and they decided in 1951 was acceptable and not acceptable content in movies. And they were terribly cranky about Klaatu's resurrection because space aliens aren't Jesus.
Right.
They didn't like that.
No.
And so they demanded that the scene where he is brought back to life be reshot to include a line making it clear that Klaatu's resurrection was only temporary and that the power of life and death was, quote, reserved to the Almighty Spirit. Mm-hmm. And so the space alien has to tell Bobby's mom, oh, no, life and death is reserved to the Almighty Spirit.
Right. And the producer said,
why did he have to say that?
The producer said, I didn't want to do it. But I had to do it because otherwise
we weren't going to be able to release this picture. That's the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Although the studio boss, Daryl Zanuck, told the production company to skip the test audiences, the production company wanted test audiences. So they waited till Zanuck went out of the country and they drove the print down to do some test audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And one reaction to the movie scared the crap out of the producer, Julian Blaustein. In the opening montage, as the military was scrambling to get to the landing site, there's a tank going around a corner and it skids a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like Fast and Furious Fort Meade drift. It's just, you know, a tank skidding.
Yeah.
Well, the audience at the test viewing laughed. And Blaustein thought, okay, that's it. We're screwed. They're going to think of this as a comedy. And in a few minutes, the audience is going to see this robot and they're going to laugh at that too. And then we have no movie. It's just mm-hmm. camp after that.
That's right.
And surprisingly, when Gort comes out of the ship, no one laughs. He's like, oh, I see. Blaustein couldn't figure out why they laughed at the tank, but not at the robot. But Zanuck explained it, that this was anticipatory and perhaps nervous laughter.
Mm-hmm.
The audience was laughing at the ridiculousness of a military thinking it was a match for an alien spaceship.
Yeah.
They weren't laughing at, you know, slapstick of a tank skidding, but that it was rushing to the spaceship as if it was going to be able to do anything. Now, the production company asked the Army if they could loan them soldiers and tanks and equipment that they'd need to make the movie. And that was a very common practice, but only if the Army approved of the script. And the Army did not approve of the script.
No, they did not.
You know, it's an anti-war movie. And fortunately, the local National Guard unit had no problem with it. So the film crew had their soldiers and had their rifles and tanks and military and jeeps and so forth. But they were all National Guard troops.
And they had them in two locations because here's some fun facts from the movie. Just we thought you'd be interested in. One of them is that the principals, all the actors, never went to Washington, D.C. There was mm-hmm. a secondary unit shooting other film in D.C. that was used as background and drop-ins and things like that. But and so all the Lincoln Memorial stuff and all the Arlington Cemetery stuff, that's all shot by the company. But none of the stars are there. They use doubles for long shots.
Yeah, a tall guy and a kid with a hat.
Yeah. And it worked great. I didn't know anything about that. Yep. It was pretty seamless. And for a movie that's over 70 years old, that's pretty damn impressive.
Yeah.
Other fun facts is originally the studio had wanted Claude Rains. You remember Louis from Casablanca. Or Spencer Tracy to play the part of Claude too, because they were stars, right? They were big names. Now, Rains was busy, so that wasn't going to happen. But Spencer Tracy really, really wanted to do the part.
He read the script and loved it and wanted to be Klaatu. Yeah.
Because Daryl Zanuck gave it to him. And Daryl Zanuck apologized to Mr. Blaustein and said, I broke my own rule. I gave Spencer Tracy the script and he loves it. He really wants to do it. He's a big, big star. And Blaustein had to explain to his friend Zanuck, his boss actually, that it would ruin everything. That they needed a stranger coming out of the ship. That some of the audience had never seen before. Who had a kind of otherworldly appearance, just kind of this person floating in from heaven to talk to human beings. But, you know, if Spencer Tracy comes down the ramp, it's just, hey, that's Spencer Tracy. Hey, look, it's Spencer Tracy. Hey, is Katharine Hepburn there? Is she on the ship too? Did you bring her too? So that's how Michael Rennie got the job. He'd never been in a film before. And Daryl Zanuck saw him on stage in Britain and signed him to a contract. And then he directed him over to the director and said, I think this guy might be the guy you want. They looked at him like for a minute and said, yep, that's our guy. So everything fell into place. The studio bought the original story from Harry Bates for $500, which seems pretty low, frankly. I mean, you get that credit on your you know, resume forever, but $500 is still pretty cheap. And the producer didn't even like the story. He'd been looking generally for a science fiction project. He wanted to do a science fiction project, especially about UFOs, since UFOs were in the paper. This was Area 51, flying saucers, that was in the air, as well as nuclear stuff. And he read, by his own account, hundreds of stories and books, and nothing appealed to him because they're all bug-eyed monsters and crazy stuff he didn't want to do. Then a guy from the Fox studio reading department dropped by and told him that he thought he'd found a story that had an interesting core to it. An alien who isn't a monster and is not here to conquer us, and our first reaction is to shoot him. And that's what the producer liked. That's what got his wheels turning. That's the story. Yeah, there's something there. So he calls his friend Edmund North, who I think they were buddies in World War II. and worked with him to sketch out the overall story he wanted to tell, and then left him alone to write the thing. And a couple of months later, the result was the first draft of The Day the Earth Stood Still. It was anti-nuclear, anti-paranoia, anti-militarism, anti-stupidity, anti-crazy yellow journalism to whip up the mob, all of which is pretty goddamn daring to a position to take during an arms race with the Soviet Union with Joe McCarthy on the loose and everybody scared out of their minds. There was a communist under every bed. Mm-hmm. Robert mm-hmm. Wise read the script and he loved it and he signed on to direct.
Yep. Yep. And the film was shot in just 28 days, which is very fast.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of organization, especially considering that Lockmartin, the 7-foot, 7-inch tall actor in the Gort suit, was rather frail and could only stand to be in this aluminum and foam rubber costume that had a frame inside and thick rubber on the outside, so it's hot and heavy. And he could only stand to be in it for 10 to 15 minutes at a time.
Mm-hmm. Plus he has to carry Patricia Neal.
Yeah. So showed that scene in the description where there's a wall that the robot walks behind to get Patricia Neal. And all of a sudden, all you see is the wall. And it's because they had to put a frame.
Like a crane.
Right. For him to carry Patricia Neal to the spaceship.
And if you look carefully, you can see wires coming off of it.
See the wires. One of the things that's really funny about that is that same kind of setup is in Pillow Talk.
Oh, really?
Yes, where Rock Hudson has to carry Doris Day down the street.
Oh, my.
His apartment. And she's in her pajamas. And he picks her up and they put a blanket over. She has this big blanket over her and he's carrying her and she's kicking and so forth. And they had to rig it so that, because no one can carry even a 110-pound woman around. Mm-hmm. Down the street and around the corner and so forth. And he's supposed to keep this woman in his arms while she's kicking, mm-hmm. you know, for a long time. And so they have this thing over the shoulders and a board and a thing. And then the blanket covers everything. And it's complicated. So this scene in this movie, you can see how this guy who, you know, has giantism, first of all.
Yeah.
And probably weak muscles as a result of that. Is challenged by having to carry Patricia Neal, and she's a little passed out at that point. She's mm-hmm. not kicking, but you see wires that are holding the board and so forth, and it's from the back, and all the camera angles they had to use where you just see her feet. And there's one point at which in the director's commentary, he said, "Now that's a dummy."
Right.
Where it's just her legs and shoes and a back shot of him walking up, and he's just carrying a stuffed pillow, you know, with two yeah. legs coming out.
Oh, well, there were three or four different suits. I mean, there was a suit yeah. for the front shots that zipped up the back, a suit for the back shot that zipped up the front.
Right.
There was
a
fiberglass statue, which they couldn't use on the ramp because the statue had flat feet. And if they put it on the ramp, it would, it would tilt forward.
So,
and they found this actor, this Lockmartin guy, entirely by accident. He was mm-hmm. 7'7", which is, you know, ridiculous in 1951. There's nobody mm-hmm. else like that. Apparently he was working as the doorman at Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Yeah.
So they're looking for somebody just to be in a suit for a few minutes at a time. Like, well, I know a guy. Yeah. You know, he's right down the street. He's an actor, but he can fill out the suit, and that's how they found him. So like I said, everything fell into place.
Now, this film was relatively expensive to make, $995,000, mm-hmm. and it did moderately well at the box office. It grossed nearly $2 million. The New York Times critic hated it, Driftglass.
Shocking. Shocking.
But the French critics loved it. And it has the distinction of turning three words in a made-up alien language into one of the most famous lines in movie history.
Gort, Latu, Barada, Nikto. Latu, Barada, Nikto.
And Wikipedia has a list of these references. We're just going to go through them real quick.
Sure.
In the 1983 film Return of the Jedi, Jabba the Hutt's employees are all like Klatoonian and Barada, and there's a species called Nikto, mm-hmm. and another Jabba the Hutt's employees is a character named Klaatu, who is also a member of the Nikto species. So, yeah. They're all over that.
In the 1987 film Evil Dead 2, the phrase is used in the final scene read out loud by the main character Ash as a way to close the portal.
In the Twilight Zone movie 1985 episode, I'm sorry, the Twilight Zone 1985 episode, Chameleon, season 1, episode 2, electronics technician Gerald Tyson, played by Steve Bassett, uses the exact phrase, Klaatu Barada Nikto, as part of some friendly banter with the boss, crew chief Brady Simmons, played by John Astin, as they are walking towards the space shuttle orbiter Discovery to change an apparently faulty cargo bay camera.
The phrase was also used in the 2013 comedy horror Scary Movie 5 as a major part of the storyline.
More Army of Darkness. In the 1992 film Army of Darkness, Ash Williams must recite the phrase in order to safely retrieve the Necronomicon. Later in the film, he must recite it again to travel back to the time period.
Yeah, these are all fan service. This is all, we all know what this means, right, guys? Right, yes, we all do. In season 6, episode 6 of Hercules, The Legendary Journeys, City of the Dead Ramses is reading a script from the Necronomicon where the final words were the Klaatu phrase, although Ramses slightly varied the last two words, saying Barada instead of Barada and Nikto instead of Nikto. So, you know.
Willie Nile uses the phrase in the bridge of his song, The Day the Earth Stood Still, from his 2021 album of the same name.
In the 2022 film, Sonic the Hedgehog 2, Dr. Robotnik quotes the phrase in the opening when attempting to escape the Mushroom Planet.
In the 1982 film Tron, Alan has the words Gort Klaatu Barada Nikto on the wall in his cubicle.
Yeah.
Now that's fan service.
Totally. And a little bit more. In season 4, episode 8 of Farscape, I Shrink, Therefore I Am, John Crichton calls the lead invasive bounty hunter Gort and uses the line, "Why don't you come down here and find me, Gort? Klaatu Barada Nikto."
I just wanted to talk. We talked a lot in this show about the difference between 1940 and 1951 and how much that contributed to the different story that's told in the movie from the short story. Mm-hmm. But I also want to talk with you about the way we as viewers see this movie now, as opposed to even 20 years ago.
Right.
I remember seeing this movie in the 70s and 80s, and it was often paired with Forbidden Planet, another 50s science fiction
movie.
Leslie Nielsen on another planet falls in love, a little cheesy.
Yeah.
You know, space. It's color. First of all, it's Technicolor. It's space aliens. It's a mystery and on another planet. Oh, and so
Invasion
forth.
Of the Body Snatchers. You would see that with this too. Yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah. And yet when I watched this one, this time, I was so impressed with the quality of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
In a different way. And it wasn't just because we watched so much. We watched the director's commentary and everything. Just watching it cold, I thought, this is an amazing movie. This isn't just a B movie.
Right.
You know, black and white B movie that's got science fiction and a robot monster that has the power to kill everybody. There is depth to this movie.
Yeah.
And I did really like the arc of the Patricia Neal character, because she is dating a jerk.
She is.
And the scene when she discovers that her boyfriend cares only about himself.
Her boyfriend is Judas.
Yeah. Yeah.
He really is. He's, and you want to describe the scene. He's on the phone. She's trying to convince him not to turn in
Klaatu. Right.
And she's trying to convince him that the world itself is at stake. And he says,
yeah, I'm going to be famous. And when you see my picture on the front of the paper, you'll change your mind and you'll love me.
And I don't care.
I don't care about humanity. Yeah.
And this look on her face, like, holy crap, has he been this way? Yeah. Oh, God, he's been this way all along.
Yeah. I'm not going to marry you. I'm not marrying anybody. I'm getting out of here. And she just leaves.
Just leaves. Yeah. Yeah. The real love story is between her and Klaatu.
Yeah.
You know,
and when they part, there is an exchange, a glance of he's got to go away.
Right.
But he loves her and she loves him. Yeah. And there's no kissing. There's no, you know, there's no Hays Code violations going on.
No.
Right.
No. This is her, you know, intergalactic Canadian boyfriend she's never going to see again. But and again, the movie the ends with, I leave it up to you to decide. You, right. Humanity, have to decide what your future is going to be. Here are two alternatives. And
it's out of my control. Right. I mean, that's the other part of the short story, which is the robot is in control of us.
Right.
Out here in the galaxy. We have put the robot in charge of whether we behave ourselves or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, we don't get any choice about the matter. We will be punished by this all-powerful robot. Who has the power to destroy planets.
Yeah, and we can't revoke it. We can't
revoke it.
We gave it the
and
power.
And all of these, they montage. They do a montage of all of these faces from different races and different religions and different backgrounds. And you realize what's at stake. And you realize, we don't know if they're going to be capable of getting along.
Oh, that's the whole point. We really don't know.
It is open-ended as to whether humanity will survive this.
Yeah.
When he leaves, we don't have an answer. It's not like, oh, well, it's life or death now. We got to decide not to use nuclear rockets or we'll all die. So I guess that takes care of the space program. We won't be using nuclear rockets. We have no idea.
Right.
That, the hubris of humanity won't take over and we can get around this.
We would be able to use, because the Klaatu's afraid we're going to apply nuclear power to our rockets. And that's fine. That would be fine, because that's clearly what he's doing. You can't bring your violence with you.
Right.
You can't be a violent species out here. You have to get along with the other kids. And if you don't, we're going to burn your planet to a cinder.
Right. And I think in the faces of the representatives of all the leaders of the world, you see panic. That, yes, the 50 of us are all well-educated negotiators, and we might be able to do something together and work out some sort of arrangement together. But our populations that we represent, we really don't have control over the mob.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something.
Well, and Klaatu is he regrets that he has to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
He clearly doesn't relish the idea of killing, 2 billion people.
Yeah,
but his species learned. This is kind of an important thing. His species, the other ones presumably, learned to do without being stupid, to learn better.
Yep.
Once they learned how to do that, then they invented the police to enforce it.
Yeah,
this is not something we have learned yet. So we're going to have to grow up really fast or die. And that really is kind of an evolutionary point. If you don't adapt to this new threat to your species, which the alternative is, you can be prosperous and happy enjoying this bunch of planets and we'll all get along, or you can all die. Those are your two choices. And I think that very accurately represents people's basic fears in the 50s of a nuclear war between the US and the Soviet Union. And it very accurately represents climate change right now. I think that's what the unspeakably bad version with Keanu Reeves is trying to do, but it really is. You don't have a lot of choices here. You can either get along and fix the problems that you all have, or you're going to die. The planet's going to die. Mm-hmm. And are you capable of making a mature decision as a species? And that's a really good question. And we have never answered that question for ourselves.
Yep. Yeah.
There's one other mention. There's one other occurrence of the Klaatu, Barada, Nikto sentence in another thing that isn't mentioned in Wikipedia. It is part of this week's Science Fiction University, which is a project of DGBG Productions, in case you didn't know that. You can support the show, if you'd like, by donating via Patreon at patreon.com/ProLeftPod. And Klaatu, Barada, Nikto, kids.